This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jenny hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. That's right, it's Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Welcome, everybody, friends across the country, all the ships at sea, listeners everywhere, joining us online, and all of our friends at Radio Free Texas. Welcome! We are coming to you from Trinidad World Recording, my recording studio here in Fort Worth, Texas, talking all things music. All things independent rock and roll, new, old, what's happening in the past that's relevant in the future. As we say, you're lost in the ship at sea. We're the lighthouse in the fog, as our man Kurt South always says. Fortunately, our guy Kurt South is not here today. Love you, South. He's worn out from playing the Stu Wiley wedding last weekend. What a show, though. Well, let me tell you who was at the Stuart Wiley wedding. If y'all didn't know, the drummer of the full band, the great Stu Wiley, got married this past Saturday. Congratulations, Stuart.
Congrats.
Yay. We are joined here today by our friends Mike Astley and Richard Marshall and Levi Marshall. Who are these people? Well, you know J.W. Marshall, bass player for the full band, hails from Effingham, Illinois. J.W. comes from a deeply rich musical family, and they are joining us here today. Richard and Mike, members of Bacon Fat from Effingham, Illinois. Pritchett fans will know the YouTube video out there of us in ragweed and Bacon Fat, Effingham, Illinois. The full band has opened up a good Midwest following here in the last couple of years, and we certainly have the Bacon Fat and the Effingham connection to thank for that. So Mike and Richard, welcome, guys. Welcome.
Greetings.
Thank you.
I hope this is a dream come true for you to be on the podcast here.
It's one of the pleasures of my life.
I know. Here in Fort Worth, Texas.
So well, far.
I became aware of you guys. I guess, you know, JW joined the band. Of course, it seems like last year because it's been like 3 years now or so. So JW was in the band. He had his iPod. I think we were shuffling through the iPod driving to a show one time. And all of a sudden, man, something pops on. There's some feedback, the sound of an air conditioning unit kind of rumbling. There's coughing, great shuffling around. And all of a sudden, just some tune starts cranking out. And I'm trying to think of what the first one was. It might have been Willin' or maybe a Jordan McCoskey song, of course, Blues.
Yeah, we did that Gate 32.
Yep. Yeah, just this raw basement high school band practice sounding thing.
Yeah.
I was riveted. I was like, who is this? He's like, J-Dub kind of goes, oh, that's Richard's band. So we knew you guys forever as just Richard's band. That's what it said on the iPod.
Yep.
Richard's band. And so, man, I gotta admit, you know, we did a lot of course, driving around, listening to music. And, boy, very often indeed, I said, man, forget this. Damn the Rolling Stones. To hell with Led Zeppelin. Put on Richard's band. And the other great thing was there was always new installments. It was all covers early on. And there was always and the covers y'all did were, you guys are huge music fans, big vinyl collectors we were happy to find. And, of course, so the covers were obscure and stuff we really appreciated. Plus, there was an outflowing Always new stuff you guys were working on. But early on, y'all started playing. What were some of y'all's covers y'all originally started with?
We started out, oddly enough, with a lot of Grateful Dead.
Oh, yeah?
Because we kind of had that just kind of jam flow. I mean, we just,
loose, freeform, jazz blues exploration.
Yep. Well, it's actually kind of funny because when we were in high school and we were just pretty much... We were worthless, but we had a lot of fun. We played a lot of old school punk music, like you know, London Calling type stuff, and some of that early Ramon stuff. Cause that's all
Clash.
We could play.
Yeah, yeah.
Just yell and scream, and the girls would come over in the basement. We have these little concerts in the basement with all these girls that are like 4 years older than us. That's the only reason we did it. We didn't. I don't even know if we liked the music we played, but the girls did. So
that's right.
It was
the raw energy that captivated not only myself. But an entire state, Illinois.
Yep.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention, of course, you know, Mike here plays guitar and sings. Richard plays bass and sings, bass and keyboards. Of course, we're leaving out a key member of the group, founding member, the great J.C. Marshall.
The great J.C.
Now, J.C. is J.W. and Richard's father. How old is J.C.?
He's going to be 62, or just turned 62.
62. Dude, J.C. Marshall's...
Are you sure, guys? I think he just turned 60 last year.
No, 61, I'm sorry. Yeah. He's 61. Born in 48.
Okay. So yeah,
he's still 60, June, I think.
61.
Still kicking, for sure.
Dude, J.C. Marshall is a legendary Midwest drummer.
That he is.
He never plays a straight beat, plays around the beat.
Oh, yeah.
Cymbals. Of course, in the Marshall house, this is when, you know, where they recorded Richard's band. And this ought to be inspiring to all you bands out there. Man, they got the basement down there. Of course, we only have basements in Texas, not really. That's kind of a Midwest and other parts of the country. The basement is just cozy. There's gear everywhere, guitars, drums. And JC is sort of the, you know, he's always just been a gear guy, a musician.
He is. He goes once a week on his trip to do business. And
yeah.
He comes back with a car full of instruments. And it's like, if you don't want them, I'll send them somewhere. And if you think we can do something with them,
yeah,
then
we'll keep them around.
We've got more instruments than we could ever enjoy.
The all-time great quote was, he's got it's a 1966 kit, Ludwig kit, 66, Black Oyster Black Pearl, Pearl. We got the shell. You know, the Ringo Starr type Beatle, old school kit down there, mint condition. Always one of the great sounding floor toms I've ever heard. Stu is down there. He's like, "Hey, JC, we ain't talking about this kit." He's like, "Oh, it's a 1966 Ludwig." He's like, "Oh man, that's awesome. Where'd you get that?" He's like, "I bought it new in 1966." He's like, "Oh, one owner." So yeah. That was just a classic line. You really don't meet. You know, you guys know that, you guys who own a lot of vintage gear and stuff. Yeah, gear gets passed around and sold, and people. It's very rare you find somebody who's owned. The other prized possession JC's got down there is the Hummingbird acoustic guitar. Oh, yeah. What is that, a 58?
58, I believe, yeah.
And then you can't forget he's got a 64 Strat that...
A psychedelic Stratocaster.
Well, you know, he always tells us, like, you know, when I bought that, everybody played Gretsches and Gibsons, and we didn't think, we just got it to throw around the stage, and then...
Yeah.
When he moved out to California, him and his buddy sanded all the finish off of it and made a psychedelic pick guard.
Did he buy it new or did he buy it like in the early 70s or something?
I think it...
He paid like $150 for it in like 60s.
It's probably around the time.
66.
It was one of those things. It was kind of like a band guitar. They all just kind of... It kind of passed hands through the band and then he just ended up with it and kind of a... Back then, everything was a sharing kind of deal.
Yeah, that's right. Communal.
Yeah.
And the commune. Well, you know, there's kind of, I read in the Clapton biography, it's funny, he bought his Strats the same kind of way. He said, you know, in the 60s, I always had like an SG or was, you know, always playing Gibsons. He said, I ran y'all probably read the book. Y'all read that in Clapton biography? Yeah, and he goes into I guess it was about early 70s. I want to say it was like 71 or 2 or 69, 70, somewhere in there. And... Yeah, the Stratocaster was kind of seen as a 50s Buddy Holly's thing. That just wasn't something guys were playing a whole lot. And it was all Gretsches and stuff like that. He said he goes into a music store. Yeah, and guy just had like 100 Strats just kind of piled up in the back. And Clapton goes, man, I'll take 100 of them. Or 50 of them or however many he bought. Made 4 or 5 of them into something that was you know, something he could really play on stage. And he said, of course, I ended up selling all those guitars for whatever fortunes, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, so JC's got the old Oh, man, that's a great strat, too. That's what I pick up every time I go over there. It's always great because the basement is always wired for sound in Effingham, Illinois, at the Marshall House. One of the great things I like to kid JW about when we go home is, of course, JC and Bev, the matriarch of the family. They still live in the family home. Now, most guys my age, I'm older than you guys, you know, your parents, once the kids are grown, you sell the house, you get an apartment, something that doesn't have any lawn work or what, you know, and so that, you know, I really don't have my own room in my parents' house, for goodness sakes. So it's so great to go to JW's house in Effingham, Illinois, and it is the family. There's just pictures of J-Dub on the wall in sixth grade with the bowl haircut, playing basketball, and faded articles of him in high school, like a, you know, newspaper articles and pictures that he drew for his mother for Christmas on the refrigerator. I'm like, dude, y'all haven't like moved out of the. This is the family home. It's very, very rare because I'd go home from college and meet friends of mine's parents, and they'd already bought a condo or something in wherever they were living. You know, it was never the family home. So a very unique atmosphere, and we just love it. Part of the reason the band goes to Effingham all the time is we just got, you know, they put us up there, great food, and let us sleep there in the house. We can practice in the basement, and then we play gigs, and it's a great time. We've gotten done a couple of Chicago shows and Champaign and other places in the area. Just a heck of a great time, man. And, of course, we've gotten to know Bacon Fast. So you guys are here in town. We're actually going to be tracking some tunes here at Trinidad tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
They brought down a whole bunch of gear. Oh, man, the 12-string Alvarez, the Gibson SG, some stuff laying around here. It's going to be all in good fun. What do y'all have? So some of the covers you're thinking about maybe trying. What are you working on? Talk about the Jackson Browne tune.
Yeah, it's the one I've been wanting to do is Barricades of Heaven. Mm-hmm. It's a Jackson Browne song.
What record's that on?
That's on Looking East, came out in...
'98,
I think. Was it that late? Yeah, I guess it was.
He only puts out a record every 4 or 5 years, so...
And it's just a song that kind of touches me. It's one of those songs that you flow through a story. Just kind of... Of evolution, you know.
Right.
Evolving, you know, but it's not too heady. It's just, you know, just smooth and enjoy it.
Yeah, man. What was some of y'all's other just original? I'm trying to remember what would have been on that original Richards Band cover tape. You did Willin', probably.
We did Willin'.
What else would have been on there?
Born on the Bayou is one that we always...
Born on the Bayou.
That's been kind of a... That's our
13 minutes long.
I think that's when we kind of figured out, you know, maybe we can do this because you know, we kind of transcended that night. And it's so different because most of that stuff you hear is really we've never been one of those bands that really works on anything. We just go in the basement, let's play this song, and usually that's the first cut of everything is what we, you know, burn on CDs for
you. That's right. You guys are going to be out of your element here in a real studio, man.
Yeah, I don't know what to do.
Yeah,
like the whole like cut, roll, up, stop, we're going to cut. We're just going to be.
I know. It's going to be out of your element, man. Well, don't worry. We, no click tracks here unless absolutely needed. So we're going to have a good time, though. Recording Bacon Fat. A lot of people will remember, fans of confused people have emailed me sometimes when they go to YouTube or on the website and they see the Flatland Jam video with you guys and my band and, of course, Cross Canadian Ragweed.
Yeah.
They're like, man, what is that, man? You're all playing I Shall Be Released or what's the other one? There's another one that's been mated on there.
We did There's Down by more. The River with Grady. Grady Cross and Stu.
Stu on the drums.
Metronome on the drums. There.
That was another 18-minute.
Well, in our next segment here, we're going to talk about that great show. That was last, I think it's going to be September this year, but I think it was October last year.
Yep.
It was in October last year. Really our first festival kind of deal. We played that Luckenbach's place. And Altamont a few times. But last year I was invited to play the Flatland Jam put on by JW's other brother, Levi, who's with us here. And put on the Flatland Jam. Oh, man, the tractor pull Friday night. Oh, my goodness. And then we have Saturday night. We had you guys. Bacon Fat was playing on the stage kind of out in the parking lot. right under the grandstand there. And then on the main stage, we had Matt Poss and us and Cross Canadian Ragweed. Was there another one? It was three bands on the inside. That was it.
Those three main, yeah.
Just the three, yeah.
So we're going to revisit last year's epic Flatland Jam in Effingham, Illinois, out at the fairgrounds. We'll explain the YouTube video and everything else and all that went on that night. It was a great clashing of worlds. Of course, I've been in the Texas music scene for a long time. I've been a lot of events like this. This was the first one this far from home where I see at least my band's music and Ragweed, some other guys I'm familiar with, playing a little bit different part of the country. Certainly a different demographic, and kind of how everybody responded on both sides I thought was really fascinating. We'll get into the Flatland Jam last year recap coming up, and then a little bit later in the vault we're going to revisit. We're pulling out all the stops here. No music in the vault per se. No album as we usually discuss. We're going to discuss one of the great rock films of all time. A movie in
one of the great
what's
movies
on P2's
of all,
iPod. Because this is on P2's iPod.
Yep.
It's something I hear a lot of young bands talk about in Texas a lot. Very encouraging. Of course, we're talking about The Last Waltz. We'll be in the vault later. Coming up, the Flatland Jam last year, 2008, when we come back.
I changed the numbers on my phone so you won't call me when I'm home, so you can't ring me up at dawn and tell me what you've been on, because I changed the numbers on my phone.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchett here. It's the P2 Podcast. We're sitting here with our friends Bacon Fat from Effingham, Illinois. Friends, family of the great full band bass player, J.W. Blue Marshall. Email us here, phil@philpritchett.com. Tell us what you'd like to see here discussed on the podcast. Give us a call, 817-733-5256. Come make your record here at Trinidad World Recording, or book the band for your next whatever. We'll play it. You heard our last podcast about us driving, me and Kurt driving out to North Carolina to play a big show. Lots of fun. Give us a call. 817-733-5256. Well, we've been talking with our friends Mike and Richard Levi, talking about J.C. Marshall, all the scene up there in Illinois, our big Midwest connection that has been so valuable and fun and life-affirming in the music business for Phil Pritchett and the full band. Of course, last year we were talking about who is Bacon Fat. First time I'd seen you guys really play, I guess, was then. I guess we'd seen you all in the basement and stuff. So, you know, no, I'd seen you all play at the Lucan Box before you got over for us, of course.
And
the first festival set.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So at the Flatland Jam, we had the tractor pull on Friday. We got there on Friday.
Yeah.
And man, it's a tractor pull, big time tractor pull. I don't think I've been that close. Front row, all access tractor pull. Might have been my first. Pretty intense. Dudes just wheeling down the backstretch. So everybody was setting up. It's still kind of nice and cool up there, October, or starting to get kind of cool at night. Mm-hmm. I remember enjoying that after a long drive from Texas. Oh my goodness, where it can still be 100 in October. So Bacon Fat was sitting up on the stage. So Saturday rolls around. You got Ragweed hanging around. You got us hanging around. Bacon Fat. The show went. Our show went great. I don't know how many we have there. Levi, a couple thousand ish, about 2,000 people. And this is kind of the first of year for this thing, right? Had y'all had a version of it? This is the first year for something like this, Flatland Jam, the inaugural Flatland Jam. So we really didn't know what to expect. You know, you had a couple kind of Texas-Oklahoma bands. But a great turnout. Of course, a lot of that's due and thanks to the Marshalls and Bacon Fat and all those guys, all you guys for spreading the word. So I seem to remember there's like a big grandstand, a lot of people. There's a lot of people there when we played, even though it was kind of early-ish. Great crowd. I got up with Ragweed and played. I can't remember what song I played with him.
You guys did Suicide Blues.
Suicide Blues. Oh, yes, of
the
course.
The Boys from Oklahoma.
Of course, Ragweed's deal is you got to make up a verse every time you get up there and sing. So
and you mentioned the classic Niemerg's.
Niemerg's.
Can't forget about
Niemerg's. Oh, man, Niemerg's in downtown Effingham. You got Niemerg's, which is a 24-hour diner?
It's not, but it's open to like 3.
Okay, but yeah. It's like a round-the-clock diner.
Pretty kind of they close for 2 hours.
Let me just say something to our recession-prone people out there. Because we feel your pain out there, folks. We really, really do. Let me tell you what. Your dollar goes a long way in Effingham. You go here to eat your hamburger, chicken fried steak in Fort Worth or Dallas or Austin. I'm telling you what. Houston, you know, $13 for lunch, $12. Niemerg's. I mean, you get the blue plate with the fried pork cutlet, 3 veggies and an iced tea for about $4.99.
Oh, yeah. It's unbelievable.
It goes a long way. I was like, dude, I could. And Stu Wiley, of course, you could still smoke in Niemerg's back then.
Yep.
Stu is just, he's got like 2 cigarettes hanging out of his mouth, eating like a chicken leg. He ordered like 2 blue plates. And
sure.
He ordered like 2 blue plate lunches, smoking the whole time, and just like, man, I'm going to move here, man. I could live in Effingham, Illinois. You can smoke. You can eat for $3. Dude, he was sold on the Midwest, man. Sold. In fact, recently, I think he was trying to get a family vacation. He was going to take his wife and was asking J-Dub. He's like, hey, man, why can't we just go stay at your parents' house? You know, just have a little, kind of like going to a resort, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Stu wants to go somewhere he can smoke and eat freely, relax, you know. When he starts thinking that, he's not going to think of some resort or the beach. He's just going to think about, of course, the Marshall's basement in Illinois.
You can't beat it.
One of the great great comments overheard for me that night was Ragweed getting off the bus, getting ready to go on, and they were doing their usual deal. They all had a cigarette in their mouth and a couple beers in one hand, and then they're all passing around a bottle of Jack Daniels getting ready to go on stage. And someone comes up to me and says, hey, man, what's going on here? And I'm like, what do you mean? And he just goes, do these guys always drink like this? I hadn't thought about it. I was like, of course. I don't know. They're a rock band. I don't know what it is. Yeah. This is how it's done. Pretty funny. I think some people are taken aback, perhaps, by some of the backstage ongoings there. But what was y'all's impression of the whole deal? I mean, how did everybody respond to the Texas? Were y'all aware of? Of course, y'all kind of knew us, but, you know, Ragweed and kind of y'all know this guy's music. How'd y'all get exposed to that up there in Illinois?
Ragweed's got a good following just about everywhere. I mean, even when I was in Springfield, I had a few friends that were diehard Ragweed fans.
Springfield, Illinois. Of course, yeah. It used to be where the Snorty Horse was. It's not still open, is it?
In Springfield?
Oh, I'm thinking Springfield, Missouri. Sorry.
Yeah.
But, no, there's a lot of venues up there.
There's quite a few places to play up there.
It's real jazz and blues.
Yeah, it's a very bluesy.
It's a real cultured town.
Blues, jazz, really. Yeah, so certainly Ragweed had made the rounds up there, bands like that. Y'all probably knew Pat Green. I don't know, who are some of these other Texas guys. But it kind of been catching on up there, I guess, the last few years. I mean, y'all...
I've heard, you know, at parties up there, people dropping, you know, some Mickey and the Motor Cars and stuff like that. It's like, I was really surprised because I'd really only heard about it from, you know...
Yeah,
hanging around with JW and Richard and you guys, but
kind of an underground, kind of cool thing off the radar.
You know, the big thing is Red Dirt Music, and there's so many people that like it. I mean,
yeah. It is kind of outside. The same deal that kind of got the whole Texas deal going a while back was it wasn't just the same slick Nashville thing. It was, you know, kind of different guys making their own stuff and, you know, touring and playing bars and sort of being out there with the folks. Well, I was real amazed how much and we still have a lot of emails from Kansas City and. Effingham, of course, and St. Louis. You know, there's little groups of people that have been to that Flatland Jam, came to our Rosebud Theater show a few months ago, who listen to the podcast, and we get some response from you. So it's been a great door-opening deal for us. But, yeah, I was struck by how many people seem really familiar with our songs and, of course, you know, cross-Canadian and stuff like that. But
hand your stuff out all the time.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I've went through hundreds of dollars of Phil Pritchett Byrne CDs.
Bless you, Mike. Bless you.
Yeah, pass it around. In everyone's collection.
Oh, it's great. You know, we talk about the Marshall family home there in Effingham. JC, the drummer and patriarch of the family, he's got a lot of memorabilia. You know, everything from coffee mugs, old baseball bats, guitars, flags, photos. Murals, anything. And I came down the stairs, and I'm greeted by a pedestal like a pedestal, like with a glass case, like something you'd see like the royal jewels kept in, the crown jewels. And it's a Phil Pritchett hat signed by me and Stu and his own son, J.W. Just display it in the glass case.
Yep.
With the copy of High Tide in the Heartland.
I know. I was like, dude, check it out. Under the glass, please do not touch.
That's valuable real estate, Val's too.
Just the old knit hat with the stitching embroidery on there. I was so honored. Oh, it was great. But, no, just a wild night. Well, you know, really, the show went off. It was great. Like a lot of shows we play, you know, we play and we get our stuff off. It was awesome. The crowd could have been better. We were thrilled about it. I sat there on the side of the stage, watched most of the whole Ragweed set. Of course, if you've seen the video on YouTube, you can search Phil Pritchett on YouTube or and you'll see the Cross Canadian Flatland Jam thing on there. So kind of the what ended up being a little bit for me anyway, the story of the show was the after show, because all that stuff you're seeing on YouTube took place after midnight. I don't know, 12:31 in the morning,
at least.
Two, three in the morning.
It went to about three, yeah.
Yeah, and we had some golf carts on the grounds. We were riding around in, wheeling around. So, yeah, I remember I was on the Ragweed bus with Cody Canada, I don't know who, hanging out, Ragsdale. But their rhythm guitar player, of course, the great Grady Cross, and Jeremy Plato, bass player. Yeah. Ragweed, who's always up for a jam.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't see them, and I didn't see Stu and JW. So I was just in there hanging out, you know, talking about the show and whatever. Yeah, and I get a text from Stu, and he says, "Hey, man, there's still like, you know, 200-400 people out in the by the bacon fat stage, the outside stage here, man. What kind of the gear's all set up? We're just goofing around." And I was like, "Okay, we'll be out there in a minute," and kind of shot him back. And so we went off a little bit, and then I get a phone call from JW, and he says, "Man," he says, "Cross is down here. You know, Plato's on bass, Richard's playing Mike, you know, JC's running around with a cowbell or something." So finally, really, Cody and Ragsdale, Randy, the Ragweed drummer, they were kind of relaxed. They were like, "I don't know." I was like, "Man, come on, let's just go out there and check out it. You know, it'd be fun." So the three of us finally kind of soldier across the now abandoned, just about abandoned, right there in front of the main stage on the county. Yeah, we get out into the little grass area behind the grandstand. It's just this party is just in full swing. I mean, there's still beer everywhere. There's people everywhere smoking, and there's loud music. And there's like, I see like eight people on the stage, and just y'all are playing like Down by the River.
Yeah.
Down by the river. Just everybody's trading instruments, and I'm like, man, this is the kind of show and the kind of gig that I want to get in on.
Well, it turned out pretty awesome because Posse just kind of like, let's keep these people around.
Yeah,
you know,
Matt
keep telling
Posse,
the bridge, like, get over there. So we, you know, we hiked down there, and Stu's right behind us. He's like, "I'm drumming."
Yeah.
And JC tried to get on the set, and he's like, "No, I got it."
Yeah, right.
He's like, "I'm not tired at all." And Levi brings up a couple cases of Miller Lite, and he's just standing on the corner of the stage, tossing them out to people.
Yeah. Well, we need to mention our friend Matt Poss, too, who we've done shows with. He was a big organizer of that, really helped kind of get the word out. Really great, Matt. So, yeah, it just turns into all of a sudden, dude, there's just guitars everywhere, people everywhere, beer everywhere. It's 2 in the morning. And me and Canada kind of huddle and go, "Hey, man, what do you do there?" Okay. So we get up there, and oh, man, it was just the kind of deal where I was up there, and I couldn't believe how many songs we could play together. Of course, my being a band leader, I've played a lot of gigs with drummers and bass players that didn't know any of my songs. How's this one go? Just G, C, and D, follow me. You know, watch me for the B minor. That's how it goes. And the drum, just give me a train beat and we'll follow in with you. So I was being the producer in the studio a little bit. So I kind of get there and I kind of become the Robbie Robertson guy, the thing or something. At least when I was up there. So we had Ike Richard was on.
I jumped to keys.
Keys. Then. And then Plato was on bass, Stu on drums. You were on guitar as well. I was trying to think which of the songs we did. Of course, we did the Dylan stuff. We did a lot of Dylan. We did
All Along the Watchtower.
That was really good. That was really good. I remember we did.
That was awesome.
Everyone does Knocking on Heaven's Door.
Yeah. You know,
we did that. We did Released, which is on there.
Well,
no, that was kind of good. But then Canada starts doing Watchtower. Mercifully, which is only three chords. Yeah. Just doing the straight, you know.
Yeah.
And he knew all the words.
Sure.
So he did it. That was good. That was a lot of fun.
Plato was just all over that on
the
bass. He was doing some crazy stuff on that one.
It must have come kind of way out of here. Do we have that on video somewhere?
You know what? Unfortunately, I think it died like just
died right
30
in
seconds into the song. And I was most you know, excited about watching that one.
No reason to get excited. Na-na-na-na-na. Well, oh man, it was just a legendary night. A legendary night in every sense of the word. We also did, Posse came out and did the Charlie Robinson.
My hometown. Or
that was good.
That was real good.
And, yeah.
Everybody just
get how many
really
songs you
song.
Know, man. And what's so great about a thing like that is it really just binds you to all these people. I mean, you kind of, you have known these guys a long time and, but not really well. But man, you get a guitar in your hand, and you all know the same songs. You know, we've all been raised on the same stuff,
sure,
and it's just cool. Just you start playing a song, everybody just nods their head and falls in line. You know,
we also did
Gary Allen, Todd Snyder. I think I'm an all right guy. We did that one.
Yeah. We did the classic Tom Petty, Last Dance with Mary Jane.
Oh yeah, of course.
We had to pull that out.
That was my influence, I think. It was my turn to sing one.
there was an attempt to start Farmer John.
We did. We played all the way.
Did we get
through
that one?
GC&D, man. That's what I was doing.
Yeah. I rocked the hell out of that. I love that.
I like the way she walks. I like the way. God, what were some other ones though, man?
We did a "Wish You Were Here."
We did a Van Morrison song. We did
"And It Stoned Me."
And it stoned me. Yeah. The ones that the full band could do, I did good. We did well. And then Ragweed. They did several, man. That
I'm trying to think.
We just followed in with them. But Watchtower was a standout.
Yeah, that was probably the best.
That was probably the best one. That was a little bit right in the middle.
Yeah, I actually took a break there. I went off stage, and as I turned around, I saw you started playing it. And I got to stand out there in the crowd and enjoy it, and I was just like, this is awesome.
Mm-hmm. But, man, just a great – I've gotten emails about it, like, ever since. People just chiming in and seeing the stuff on YouTube. Of course, it's just sort of a jiggled handheld deal. But you get a real good sense of it. And the sound, the kick drum kind of – pops through on the audio, but it really sounds pretty good. You get a good sense for what's going on. There's a lot of people and a lot of wildness going on. I just remember how late it was, and it got real cold. It was like 3 a.m. It's one of those things you're playing.
The dews started coming up. And
yeah, you look at the dews coming up. There's just steam coming off of all of us. And
Yeah,
they're supposed to leave. Ragged was leaving like at 4 a.m. to drive to their next deal in Chicago. So about 3:30, we kind of wrapped it up. But it was one of those things I felt like I'd just been up there for like 15, 20 minutes. I've been up there for like 2.5 hours. Yeah, I played keyboards on something. Did I do Willin' on the keys?
You did that, and you did Mary Jane's Last Dance. You played the keys on
that. Oh, okay, yeah.
Because
me
and Cody were playing
that one.
Yeah,
so I got to play some keys live. Yeah. And it was just a blast. So needless to say, we're coming back next year. I think the next episode, we'll talk more about what's to come in the Flatland Jam for Phil Pritchett and the Full Band and Bacon Fat next year. Well, guys, are you ready? The last waltz. Can you opine? Can you give me a hot music opinion on the last waltz here in our final vault section? Because if you don't, Mike, I'm gonna lay out
an idea.
Okay.
And a belief in this one.
Okay.
See if anyone agrees with me. And I've been waiting and saving.
Mike is known for his opinions. Like he hates the Eagles. And he loves Tom Waits and thinks Journey sucks.
Worst band ever.
Yeah, worst
That's
band
exactly
ever.
That's exactly what it is. Worst ever.
No holds barred.
I don't know if you'd get a whole lot of arguments around some of these parts with some of that stuff. Well, coming up here, we always do an album. We're kind of doing an album here, but really it's the film. We're going to do some rock movies here in the next episode or two as we look at one of the greatest rock movie documentary, of course, of all time. The Last Waltz in the vault when we get back.
We were hungry, just a barely alive. By May 10th, a Richmond had fell. In the time I remember oh so well, the night.
fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It's Phil Pritchett on the P2 Podcast. Thanks for listening at philpritchett.com and all of our friends at radiofreetexas.org. Thank you, folks. Enlightening your musical life. With me is Bacon Fat from Effingham, Illinois, making a record here at Trinidad World Recording, or at least recording just some loose jam kind of stuff, talking about all our great times in the Midwest we've had with these guys, the Flatland Jam last year. Well, J.W. Marshall, full band bass player, his brother Richard, Richard's friend Mike, had formed Bacon Fat. Of course, when we went to Effingham for the first time to play, what's the little place? Not Luckenbach's, the other place.
Sneaky Pete's.
Stinky Pete's?
Sneaky.
Sneaky, sorry. Sneaky Pete's. Played Sneaky Pete's. JC, the dad, he made some posters. You guys get some posters up there. Played a club show there. Very fun, Sneaky Pete's. Initiated everybody to Phil Pritchett and the full band. And I think the second time we went to Effingham, it was Luckenbach's.
Yep. In the snow.
Was that the blizzard?
That was the blizzard.
The blizzard. Dude, it snowed. I mean, it snowed. Well, while we were in there, it snowed a foot.
Oh, there wasn't any snow when it started.
It was like drifted up to the car. I couldn't open the back door. I mean, it was incredible snow. Huge snows in the Midwest. Played those shows. Of course, all the while, we're hanging out with Richard and Mike and realizing, man, these guys, they just have piles of vinyl, man, in Richard's house. Richard's band, the Basement Tapes we were talking about earlier, filled with old, classic rock gems, rarities, all kinds of great stuff. So, of course, inevitably, the talk always turns to films, music, stuff like that. Of course, we're always talking about The Last Waltz, you guys being such huge band fans. It's funny, because in recent years, the band has, in the Texas music world, for so long, all anybody knew was Willie Nelson's Greatest Hits and Viva Terlingua by Jerry Jeff Walker and Robert Earl Keen, Number Two Live Dinner. You know those three things. You start a band, you make an album on a credit card or something like that, and you get out there and play some gigs. That's just kind of how you start your Texas music. And that's the knowledge people had. Any knowledge they had of, like, Dylan or anything was not a lot more than the Greatest Hits or something like that. But I feel like in recent years, man, I do have a lot of young guys coming into the studio and talk about Dylan and talk about the band, talk about how many times they've, seen The Last Waltz and Van Morrison, of course, and Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and all the people who are in the film. And it really gives you a good backdrop to kind of discuss music, to talk about, who these artists are and stuff like that. And you guys yourselves are authorities, of course, on The Last Waltz. So it binds you to what's going on there in Texas right now. Where did y'all first become aware of all the, the band, the classic rock kind of thing, Richard?
Well, my dad was a pretty big influence in it. I mean,
we gotta say JC is just, I mean, he's in a time warp from the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he never sold out, did he? JC?
Oh, no.
No, I mean,
I don't think he knows how to.
He still drums, still talks about the old days, the 60s, traveling the country, very much lived a, lived in the era, man, for certain. So he was, of course, a big influence.
What always intrigued me, it's still in the basement, a photograph of the band, and he's kind of got it.
It's kind of like a log cabin type.
Yeah,
deal.
And it's
like
black
with the
and
beards
white.
And just
black and white.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just
yeah.
A row of them.
So was that there as a child that had been in the house?
And it was always like, who are these guys?
Well, I can.
Are those my lost uncles?
Who are these grizzly people? I mean, they just looked like. I mean, it looked like could have been like shot in 1852.
Yeah, they look like they're just mining for gold in Cripple Creek or something.
I remember the first time that we saw The Last Waltz. It's actually because my dad has always been a huge Neil Young and the band fan and Dylan and. One year for Father's Day, he's like, The Last Waltz is being re-released on DVD, remastered and everything. He's like, I want that for Father's Day. So I go out and I buy it for him, and I watch it with him once. I'm like, well, that's mine now.
So
I took it and I took it over to Richard's house, and we watched it like 3 times in a row. Like, we just couldn't get enough of it. We just kept starting it over. And you just become obsessed with it. It's just...
Man, and you know what? It's like any great film, any great book, any great song... It just, the older you get and the more you experience and you go back, the more you get out of it every time. Because there are parts of it, as a kid that have really appealed to you. you know, the live performances. You're like, wow, there's Neil and Dylan and stuff. And, you know, and when I saw it in high school a lot, you know, started kind of getting into the, all that kind of stuff. Not quite, you know, when Robbie Robertson talks about being in a band's a goddamn impossible way of life, you know, at 17, before you've really tried to make a living playing music, that kind of flies right over your head, and you're waiting to see the Dylan scene. But I can tell you, you know, when you get in your 30s and you've been playing a lot of shows and a lot of bars, and he's talking about playing at Jack Ruby's bar for four people, and, you know,
fight breaks out.
It's a goddamn possible way of life. And talking about how you can push your luck on the road and stuff like that. And, you know, where I am now in my life, that really hits home. I mean, it's something, there's all sorts of stuff about that movie and that you can pull stuff out of it at different parts of your life.
Yeah, I just think, I mean, the music is, you know, great. But I just think what Scorsese did with the scene, you know, just the interviews, I mean, just the one scene that really just gets me is when they're in the studio and Rick Danko's kind of, you know, just kind of over the soundboard. He's got his hat on and he's just kind of...
Ain't no difference. Is it that's playing or is that...
No, it's like a new song that he's singing. Oh, that's right. I can't remember. Yeah. And he's going like, what are you playing here? He's like, oh, it's just some new stuff. And he just looks so tired. And he's just like,
yeah,
it's not all what it's cracked out to be, even though it's been a great run. It's just kind of like, this... life will kill you.
Yeah, he still has to make music. Yeah. You know, what's he going to do now? He's a musician, you know. Of course, those of y'all who may not know, tell us more about the band. Who is the band?
Well, you know, you've got Garth Hudson.
The great
Garth Hudson.
Someone who can play anything. I mean,
just
the guy,
a musical genius.
But mainly played B3, right? When you
organ, yeah, right. B3 and a clavinet and everything.
If you hear anything obscure, it's him.
So of course the great Robbie Robertson, kind of leading the band leader, playing the Strat up front through the Music Man amp.
Yeah, and Rick Danko, you know, the bass,
kind of the
high harmonies.
He's got a childish kind of, just young. I mean, just a far out dude. Just,
yeah, yeah.
Something real innocent, but just
the
full
the,
life.
The extremely underrated Levon Helm, probably one of the greatest drummers I've ever heard, and Everyone wants to talk about Keith Moon.
Field.
Oh, I know. And Keith Moon and John Bonham. And yeah, they're great drummers, but it's like Levon Helm, he's got it.
He's kind of like, we're talking about JC, Richard, your dad's drumming, how he plays around the beat.
Oh, yeah.
And man, a lot of those guys played like that. I mean, you know, Bonham would straighten out a little bit here and there, but, you know, Moon and all those old kind of, you know, 60s bands, man, those guys played around. And Helm certainly did. I mean, just you just don't know where he's going to come in out of a little fill sometimes or a little roll, you know.
He's always got that like little roll on the snare. It's never just a straight pop on the snare.
Yeah, like a little flam on the snare. He does it on the hi-hat a lot. Just real funky little fills and stuff like that. And who else? We got Richard Manuel.
Heart and soul of the band.
Really? Is that right? Why would you say that, Mike?
I think there's been a lot of speculation as of, did Robbie Robertson really write as many songs as he did? And I really think that the band lived off that. Mm-hmm. I think really the core of the band was, if you ask me, like Levon, Danko, and Manuel just made that. They had that real tight.
Yeah.
And it allowed Garth Hudson just to, you know, do his amazing, you know, symphony like playing all the time. And
now, to give our some perspective, the band, of course, were the guys that everybody knows as the band. They were in Woodstock. The round before that, playing with what's his name?
Ronnie Hawkins.
They were the Hawks.
They were the Hawks, playing bars forever. So they came to prominence, of course, when they got together with Bob Dylan in Woodstock.
65, they hooked up with Dylan for the Highway 61 tour.
Right.
You know that
great
Highway 61 album when he did it with Bloomfield and Al Cooper. And then he didn't have a band to tour with, so he picked up the Hawks, and that's where it started. They went over to England. You watch all those footage of Dylan getting booed off
getting
the stage by all the beats.
That was the Hawks, yeah.
That's the Hawks right up there behind
them.
That
was sort of the developing. Helm wasn't with him then, isn't that right? Didn't he kind of come later?
He was with them when they went with Dylan.
Okay.
But he wasn't in the original formation of the Hawks.
Okay,
I don't remember who their drummer was. But.
So the band, of course, I guess they came back. Of course, Dylan kind of drops out of the scene after that, the quote-unquote, you know, the motorcycle wreck and all that in 66. The band, when did the first band album come out?
68, I believe, Music from Big Pink.
Yeah, yeah.
They bought that big pink house in the middle of the Adirondacks.
Right. Had that. And then that's where Dylan started jamming with them a little bit.
That's where most of the material on the Basement Tapes came from.
Basement Tapes.
It was released much later.
Yeah. Was So then the Dylan and the Band release, was it Planet Waves? Was that their first?
Yeah, I think that was their first full-length studio album together. Bob I think Dylan it was actually their only one,
with the
really?
Band, yeah. I think it was, yeah. And then they had the After the Flood. And that was kind of the beginning of the comeback with Dylan, the 74 tour. Yeah. Of course, they made the live album of Blue. Blue Marshall has just walked in the studio.
Welcome.
In the podcast. Welcome, Blue.
A new Last Waltz enjoyer.
Oh, yes. Very nice.
Tap the vault of it.
So they had a... What am I trying to think of, Mike? Before the Flood live album.
Before the Flood.
Which is amazing.
So, great album.
So the band... The whole premise of the Last Waltz is the last band concert ever.
Correct.
No, is it Winterland? Is that the San Francisco?
It was at Winterland, yep.
That's San Francisco, right?
Yep. Yeah, 78, was it?
78? Yeah, it was late
70s. This was LA, yeah.
So what happens in the film, of course, is you know, you got the interviews with the bands, a lot of poignant interviews, great thoughts on that, like I say, really hit home as a touring guy. Well, you know, of course, you got the great live performances, the whole concert. Oh, they're sure. Bringing in all the great friends. What's your highlight, Richard, from the
concert?
Who steals the show?
Van Morrison.
Van Morrison?
Yeah. I think so.
He has it. He totally did, didn't he? That's all.
Oh, well, he big timed it. He took it.
Him and Manuel do the duet. It's unbelievable. Lura is just phenomenal.
Oh, yeah, just, yeah. That's pretty crazy.
Irish lullaby.
Now, I want to know how Neil Diamond got wrapped up in all this thing. Because that is a little strange. Of course, he was at his peak then, man. I mean, just about.
Well, you know, they talk about that a little bit in the movie. You know, Robbie's sitting there and... They met him over in Tin Pan Alley because that's where, you know, Neil Diamond was a great songwriter before he ever became a commercial success with his, you know, Cherry Cherry.
That's the
and all
big
that.
One he... I'm a Believer. He wrote that, didn't he?
Yeah.
Then I saw her face. Now I'm a Believer for the Monkees.
He wrote all sorts of great songs.
Yeah, tons of stuff, yeah.
Like Red Red Wine, which we were talking about that yesterday. The UB40 made it like a reggae hit, and he had written
that was a Neil
red,
Diamond song?
Red Wine, yeah.
Red, Red Wine.
Oh, I really
wow,
love that.
I didn't know that.
Well, he did, you know, Girl.
Huh?
Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon.
You'll Be a Woman Soon.
Which, Urge Overkill did.
Urge Overkill for Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, you'll be a woman soon.
Oh,
before
so
the sequins
great.
And everything.
Oh, yeah, dude. Hot
all
August Night.
Jazz
what
singer.
Was that? What was Hot August Night?
Oh, I don't know.
Late 70s. Oh, I mean, that was right around that era.
And it was like right around the Jazz Singer. That was like 77, I think.
Who else comes out and jams with the band? Of course, you got Eric Clapton comes out.
Oh, yeah.
Where Strat breaks. Everybody talks about that. Or it doesn't break. It just kind of comes off.
I love Dr. John.
Dr. John rips it up. Ringo's on stage from time to time.
I'm a big fan of the Butterfield.
Yeah,
Mystery Train.
Yeah, yeah,
that was pretty cool.
Hell yeah. Of course, the other big ones were, you know, Joni Mitchell.
Doing the Coyote.
Yeah, and Neil Young, of course.
Helpless is...
Y'all's bit. That was pretty great.
Yeah.
I love it where they come in on the chorus and then they back off. Isn't that helpless where they come in? Hell yeah. You see him back off. He starts the second verse, you know?
Yep.
And he kind of laughs, like, whoops.
You know,
that's what makes that movie so good.
Yeah.
You tell. See, back then they didn't overdub anything. If that was made today, they'd go back and punch everything in, everything up on Pro Tools and stuff. Or Clapton would have stopped the show and fixed his strat and said, start over. But there's that element, man. And I love watching Robbie Robertson in the middle, man, just waving at everybody and pointing and messing with his amp and tuning his guitar and playing a solo while Clapton's trying to catch his guitar. Just you just sense this trying to pull off the show element. I think just drives those live performances, man.
It's great how, you know, I mean, those guys all live together and, you know, I mean, just the history, it's just kind of like they've been playing with each other forever, even if they never played with each other. And
it's a culmination of all those years. Well, as he said, played bars for 8 years, then played stadiums for 8 years. You know, that's kind of how it shook out, you know.
It's just,
so I guess Robertson, he's probably 36 or so when they...
He's probably, mid-30s.
Almost 40 in that movie, maybe, when they just quit doing it, late 30s. Probably so, man.
They started really young, so I would say probably mid-30s.
Yeah, 36, man.
But they look so old because they all look like Father Time with their beards. And
yeah.
It's like Garth Hudson was born with that beard, and he looks like he's about 70 at the age of 18. I mean, every picture you see of the band, he's got that beard. It's just...
Well, help some of our some of our listeners out there in Radio Free Texas Land. Might not have seen the film. A lot of people haven't seen it. What are some key band music, you know, to really latch onto in the film or on any of their albums? You know, what's kind of a good band starter point for the band?
Well, the weight's obvious. I think it's
The weight. We did
Night they drove Night Dixie drove down. Dixie.
Yeah,
the songs that a lot of people probably know. You know,
sure,
and maybe not familiar that it's the band.
Yeah, did the band do it? Yeah,
I think everybody should own music from Big Pink and the band. Their second album, which is self-titled, The Band.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a true music lover, you either own it or you need to.
Yeah.
So.
Music from Big Pink and
I think
the
a good
band.
Summation of their sound is "Don't You Do It." That really's got a that whole song's got kind of their whole kind of what they look for.
Which one was that on of those two?
They did that on Moondog Matinee.
Oh,
which
okay.
Which is their like homage of the '50s.
That's got a.
They do it on Rock of Ages, which is probably the best version of it.
Yeah,
the horn section.
Yeah,
they got the horn section with it. Yeah. Which they do on The Last Waltz too.
Well, man, you know what's really, I think it's, people get angry about this. I watch a lot of movies and stuff, and people, I've never been just the biggest Scorsese. I mean, I always liked his stuff. I always thought he was a little overrated. The Last Waltz is his best film he ever made. That's the best thing he's ever put together.
Yeah, I agree.
I thought, I don't know. I feel like a lot of his style can be overwhelming in some things, but on The Last Waltz he plays it very, and he tells a compelling story, the way it's laid out with the interviews, the show, and the background. It gives you a really good sense of history of the band, and where they've come from, where they're going, and like you said, talk about like Danko at the, you get a sense that these guys, you know, what are they gonna do when this band's over with, you know? And the truth is, none of them did really well, save for Robbie.
Robbie's doing great.
He did good.
You know, it's kind of like goes back to that.
It's a
same,
swan song deal.
Yeah, like
you know.
Richard Mann is like,
sure.
I just want to break even. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, I mean, this has been such a great run that you know maybe I won't be rich forever, but as long as I break even.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I don't think it worked out for him the way he thought he would.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, who was Rick Danko's passed away?
He passed away in '98,
and Richard Manuel also.
He committed suicide in '96.
That's
hung
right.
himself.
So you've got, still got Garth Hudson out there.
Garth? He's actually making piano duet albums with his wife, Maude.
Is that right?
Yes.
Only Mike Astley would know that. So
I've considered ordering it. So I could give a broke guy, you know, $10.
Yeah,
I mean, it might not
be
worth anything, but I love him so much that
of course, Robbie Robertson, he still looks the same with his black hair and sunglasses when he shows up at the Grammys or wherever he is. Of course, Levon Helm, I guess he had cancer, throat cancer, almost died.
Got it fixed.
Now gives concerts in his backyard in his barn, last I heard.
That was years ago. He just won a Grammy last year for his album, The Dirt Farmer, which is an incredible album. It's like a really rootsy, bluegrass, country-type album.
Yeah.
He's got this big 10-piece band. It's a really good album. And he was on Conan
promoting
it.
Oh, okay, cool. Looking good, sounding good?
Yeah, I guess he had to like have reconstructive surgery on his voice.
His voice is back to the way it was.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Sounds pretty good, huh?
I mean, he sounds old, but he sounds like Levon, and he's still got the
drumming.
Yeah. Dude, good deal. So you got Levon, Robertson, and Garth still around, huh? Still around kicking. I wonder what Hudson would charge me to come in and play some organ on some of my records.
Probably nothing.
Huh? $100, you think?
As long as you pay for him to get there.
Buy him a chicken fried steak across the street, and he might show up, huh? You think? Where does he live now?
I think he lives in Dad
was trying to pull that thing off with him and Brad Davis, and I think he was in Nashville last time.
Hudson.
But that was like 4 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I think he's still in the scene, but... The
band, man, a great, you know, sort of that whole movie, man, The Last Waltz, you get those great guys. It's almost more than the fall of the band. That was right at the disco era kind of coming in, which was really the at least the temporary death knell for a lot of those classic bands. You know, you just had disco coming in, the 80s. You wouldn't hear from Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison, the same way or as much through the 80s.
Well, that was kind of...
Maybe the 90s. You know what I'm saying? Really, that's it's not just the swan song of the band, kind of the end of the, you know, the mid-70s. It was the swan song for a lot of those guys.
That's what I want to say. I think it was just pretty much, honestly, I think that marks the last waltz for music as we know it and as music as it was known.
Yeah, I think so,
like,
too.
I mean, not to say that there haven't been other great bands that come through, but, I mean, it's like the end of the 70s.
When you got the Staple Singers.
Yeah.
Kind of the old school, you know, Ronnie Hawkins. They had the 60s, early 50s rock and roll stuff. This is what these guys, you know, Buddy Holly's talked about. You know, I mean, there's those guys have a sense of history, of the 50s. They were there for the 60s, the 70s. They made it all happen. And here they are playing one last great show together, all of them, before it sort of goes away for a while. And it won't be the same ever again. A lot of them aren't going to live. Of course, back then when they're making the film, they didn't really know all this. But well, it's very poignant. And like I say, the older I get, the more poignant things there are. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, a lot of these guys passing away. A lot of these guys, you hear that, man, he's broke, he's having a hard time. You know, you don't hear anything about him.
Well, I think they knew something was changing. And they saw that they had enough respect for music that they saw that why not go out with this climactic thing and then just kind of just...
Yeah.
The new age is coming in, and why try to fight it and just get pushed under the rug?
Right.
Why not
right.
take it while it's there to be taken?
Yeah.
And I think go with it.
I think it was the best way to do it, though, honestly. I don't think they should have done it any other way because, I mean, even their albums were starting to get a little bit... You could tell they were trying to fight the times a little bit, but it wasn't taking... And they didn't really want to rust, and they had such a great,
yeah,
you know, I mean, just a great history. I mean, they might not be, you know, the quintessential group that everyone talks about at that time, but it's like,
right. They're certainly a music. They're one of those. They're a musician's band, you know. I mean, they're people who love to play and have a lot of respect for the musicianship of acts. All talk about the band, and definitely. Even your biggest stars, Neil Diamond or whoever.
Yeah,
would have a lot of respect for the band, and that comes through in the movie, man. How those guys just fearlessly pull people up and jam on stuff, and it's an amazing thing to watch. Scorsese's best movie he ever made, The Last Waltz, becoming just as well known. I'm pleased to see in kind of the young Texas music guys red dirt scene, man. People talking about The Last Waltz, and you got Stoney LaRue and guy. You hear these guys doing Forever Young and, you know, the Dylan stuff and a lot of stuff from that era that's associated with The Last Waltz. Well, man, that's been some rock movie talk here on the podcast. Email us, phil@philpritchett.com. Let us know what you think about the podcast, what you'd like to hear addressed, or call us, 817-733-5256. My deepest thanks to Levi Marshall, promoter of the Flatland Jam, who has been here today. And also my deepest and most sincere thanks to Bacon Fat members, Richard Marshall and Mike Astley from Effingham, Illinois, for sitting here on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Appreciate it.
Well, coming up in our next podcast, we're going to talk a little more, I think, next week about the future of the Flatland Jam. We're going to be going back there. We'll probably touch on that next time. But until then, take care of yourselves out there. Rent The Last Waltz and check it out. Or just go rent it for the 200th time, or buy it or download it. Check it out. Dig in deep and enjoy. For Phil Pritchett and all my Bacon Fat guests here, signing off. Be good to each other out there. We'll see you soon.
Bring on one more very good friend of ours. Bob Dylan.
Follow you down.